If I had a crystal ball and I went back in time, I would have done so many things different. I would have done so many things on a higher end, and I would have fixed this and done that. And, you know, unfortunately, that's just how business rolls, you know, and I had to sort of just cop it on the chin and start small and just work my way through it.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Suburban restaurants are the lifeblood of the hospitality sector, hubs of the community, a place to dine and imbibe in a relaxed, often family-run environment. But occasionally a few diamonds come along that push the culinary envelope to creating a dining destination outside the CBD. Joshua Mason is the owner of Qua Dining in Baulkham Hills and soon to be opened Seol Restaurant and Bar at Seol Wines. Joshua, how are you?
Yeah, really well. How are you going?
Good. It's great to get you on the show. You're a pretty busy man. How are things going?
Yeah, I think I'm that individual that kind of likes to stay busy. I like to wake up in the morning going, awesome, I love a full day, I love a challenge, and I try to accidentally squeeze my days as much as I can. It's been pretty crazy in a sense to, you know, what's happening right now and what's to come. It's been rather challenging. It's interesting financial times going on in the industry right now with, a lot of closures, a lot of cutbacks and whatnot. So, yeah, it's definitely a challenge for sure.
Well, you are incredibly busy, but you also managed to have the only Hatted restaurant in the Hills District. What's that like, sort of setting the dining benchmark in a suburban area like that?
Yeah, I'm really humbled by it. I came to Baulkham Hills or the Hills District some 8 years ago, and actually at that time I was dating somebody up in the Hills, and I was actually coming from the city a lot, and I was driving up to the Hills and back and forth, and being a true gentleman that I was back then, and a youngster, I would get in the car and drive up to the Hills and pick up this young lady and go for dinner, and then drive back to the Hills and back to the inner west again. And I went, there's got to be an answer up in the Hills of Sydney. And over time I thought, you know what, I would like to be that answer. And I've been sort of waving the flag since 2017 of quality dining in the Hills District, and super proud to be up here with an awesome group of locals.
Does it have its challenges sort of setting that sort of benchmark and delivering dining of that quality in that region?
Absolutely it does. And the reasons why it is very tricky is when you're dealing with, you know, about 160 to 200,000 people in a pretty controlled area, it doesn't take long for word to spread if something's not up to the standard. So you need to be very, very careful of how you relationship manage and the quality of the product. It needs to come out. You need to show the passion and the dedication, and they will give you a fair go up here. And most local places will give you a fair go and make you your local if you can connect on the level that they like.
Of course, we're talking about Qua Dining here, but you have many sort of arms to your business, including Seol Wines. Tell us a little bit about all the various things that you are sort of involved with at the moment.
Yeah, so once again, I like to stay busy, and I was a raging wine collector pretty much my whole life, and I can always span back to my city days as a young apprentice, working under various French chefs. I used to swap my overtime hours for French bottles of wine and do all these bits and pieces. So I started growing this really amazing collection of a personal wine cellar, and it only got to about 6 years ago. My wine cellar was so full, and I spent so much time selling everybody else's product. I went, you know what? I would really like to connect on a level of making wine and trying to put my chef head into a bottle. And I went down to Barossa. I was actually born in the Hunter Valley, but I'm not a massive fan of Hunter Valley wine. I find the environment there is really harsh. But went down to Barossa, immediately fell in love with Barossa and went, oh my God, South Australia is gorgeous. Like, what a place. And, connected with a couple of very talented winemakers like Jason Collins, Angus Wardlaw, Tom White, and so willingly, after a couple of nights out of getting on the piss with the wines, they were like, actually, we don't mind this. We don't mind this chef from Sydney. Let's help. It started off with a Shiraz. It started off with a Pinot. Very passionate about Shiraz and Pinot. We sold every single bottle of the Shiraz and Pinot. Like, and to be fair, I actually oversold it and had to go back to some of people's wine cellars and buy them back because they bought too much of it. So we oversold it, and at that time I was like, okay, a business is born. Like, this is really cool. So I've been expanding on that project for almost 5 years, and I'm very proud to have a very awesome lineup of wines with a premium cloud series we just released, and about 27 venues in Sydney who all purchase the wines and pour them by the glass, and which is very cool. And we've got about 100 paying members. And a lot of people do ask, why did you do it? And I said, well, number one, I've got a huge passion for wine. Number two, I needed to get my wife off my back because I kept buying wines from all these different places, ended up on my doorstep. So there's only one way to get her off my back, which is just dive into a business and go, yeah, but honey, if it makes money, you know. She can't argue with a warehouse full of pallets, unfortunately. And three, it was another acquisition for me to go, what is the long play here? We all understand the life cycle of a chef, and a life cycle of a chef is quite interesting. There's a pinnacle, there is a peak somewhere, and there's a decline at some point. And when that decline comes is usually when a lot of chefs start to run into a lot of issues, a lot of problems, and they actually start to fall out with their own identity of where they are in life, what they're doing, what's their next play. So for me, the wine was something that, A, keeps me involved in hospitality. It allows me to continue to use my taste buds and my making skills, and it's something that it will never die. Wine shouldn't go off. If it's a good quality, you can expand on that project for the rest of your life. So, about 14 months ago, I purchased my first vineyard with a beautiful home on there. And, we rent the home out. It's 10 acres. I bought that vineyard off Kellermeister Wine, so it's a very good vineyard. And, really happy to go down to Barossa and, drink an excessive amount of wine for a couple of days and come back with sunglasses on the plane. It's great.
And soon you'll be opening another restaurant as well. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I am actually. So we're in the sort of the fit out stage at the moment. So we're the first rooftop bar, sort of restaurant and bar in the Hills District. So massive love and support for that already. And if some of the listeners don't know the area of the Hills District, but it's probably one of the fastest growing areas in Australia at the moment. So I've picked a little pocket in Norwest Business Park where there's a quite a substantial amount of building going on there right now. If anyone wants to go take a vacation up there for a couple of hours and go for a drive, there was an awesome building which is called Infinity Park getting built at the moment, which is a residential and commercial. And I was wondering why these builders kept coming to the restaurant a couple of years ago and having lavish lunches and buying French wine and doing all the rest of it. And one day they came in and said, come over here and sit down. And I was like, oh no, what have I done? what's going on? And they sat down and they pulled a plan out and said, we're building another commercial tower, and we would love for you to take on the rooftop restaurant on top of 100 commercial offices. What do you think? And to be fair, at that time, I had no anticipation to opening up another solo venue, because we all know, if there's a lot of chef listeners out there, it's not easy. It's really, really hard. But how many times do you get an opportunity when someone goes, hey, we've got your back, here's a rooftop restaurant, let's work on this together type of thing? And I went, you know what, that's not going to come around often. Took it on 2.5 years ago, and now we just released the bookings a couple of days ago, and it's been an overwhelming amount of love and support. So, super appreciative.
That's amazing. Well, I want to explore all these things that you're doing in greater detail a bit later on. But take us back to when you were young. Whereabouts did you grow up and what sort of role did food play?
Yeah, so born Hunter Valley, grew up on the Central Coast. So, did all my schooling years on the Central Coast. Interesting childhood, definitely by any means no silver or gold platters. Divorced parents, so, living home with mum and dad was definitely a high achiever. He was in hospitality and also was a chef too many moons ago. So, yeah, he had venues and was very connected to food at that time. Pretty much between playing rugby league, which was a massive passion, and rugby union and schoolboys footy and all the rest of it, I would go and cook on the weekends at one of the venues on the Central Coast, or if not one of my dad's venues. And I was very much connected to food, pretty much maybe like he was when he was younger. And I kept that in the background my whole sort of schooling years. I'd go to school with my knife kit and I'd get teased at school by everyone going, "Oh, you got to go to work," type of thing. And I was like, "Yeah, okay, you say that now, but I'm going to keep working. I'm going to keep working hard, and I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to get this done early." And I'm very appreciative that I did stick to it. I came from on my mum's side, in a Sicilian family, so plenty of yummy food on the table all the time. Celebrations were great. The pasta was beautiful. The trifles were delicious. The pavlovas were the best, and they still are today. So my nunu and nunna still live on the Central Coast at the moment. And we're very much connected on a two-way street, on a commercial point of view with my dad, and on a cultural point of view with my grandparents.
Was there any sort of advice that you've received from your father and the experiences you've had with him from his experience in hospitality that you utilize now?
Don't do hospitality. It took many years to convince him that I had it covered and I was okay. He's no longer in hospitality at the moment. He's off doing other weird and wonderful things. He's doing community housing and whatnot and trying to help on a different level. I think he spent a lot of time in hospitality. He knew the effort. He knew the struggles. He knew how much it takes out of you, how much effort you have to put in there day in, day out. I'm very lucky that I have a massive amount of energy every day that I'm able to do it and not feel too rattled by it. But you never know where life takes you. You don't know at what point the body just goes, "No, that's enough." So, yeah, his advice was, just put your head down and do as much as you can. And, during this time, I'm 29 at the moment, so I've got a fair few years left to grind, and we'll just see where things take me.
Take us to the sort of early stages of your career. What were the sort of important venues and people that had a big influence on you as you built your career?
So quite an interesting one. So I basically stopped playing footy. So I got as far as playing reserve grade for Tigers at Balmain with Liam Roach, Blocker Roach's son, was my coach. It was an interesting situation, and I was obviously on the weekend, I was still cooking and I was still doing an apprenticeship at the same time. So I was like, I was doing training, hardcore training, and then going to bend over into fridges as an apprentice and just like feeling my body was going to collapse. And I kind of felt at that time, I was like, I don't stand a chance of it, against these 120 kilo guys. Like, this is too hard. My body's just not coping. So I pulled out of football and basically dove straight into cooking pretty quickly. I went and worked for an emerging French bistro in the inner west of Sydney with a Michelin star French chef. Really took the reins there as much as I could as a youngster and put 100% of my energy into it. And at the same time, because I still had that competitive spirit, I really wanted to also keep that competitive spirit going. So I actually basically signed up to as many cooking competitions as I could. I was like, I want to know everything. I want to know everything as soon as possible. So I got to work with the likes of, you know, Victor at Ormeggio. I did a really cool stage of Mark Bess at Mark when he was still open. I got to learn from some amazing dessert and pastry chefs and whatnot, and got like the best possible training to be able to go and represent Australia on a national level. And in 2014, I received a national gold medal for best chef under, I think it was under 25. So really pushed it, went and competed in India, went and competed in New Zealand. And then I think at that point, there was so much government pressure on this competition to really, really excel. And they put so much pressure on me that I actually at that point had to take a step back, going another self-evaluation. What do I want to do moving forward? Do I want to be a competition chef, or do I want to be a restaurant chef, and do I want to connect with customers? And I had to choose a route. And so I did everything I possibly could do in Sydney, and jumping from restaurants and getting as much experience from so many different experts that I went, you know what, my time in the competition career is done. I've got sponsorships. At the time I was actually sponsored by Renault cars. I was driving a Renault car at like the age of 20 years old. I had Victorinox knives, and you know, they've now we've actually rekindled our relationship with Victorinox at the moment. I was doing stuff as a 20 year old and bouncing around as a 20 year old, getting the best knowledge and didn't care what time of day it was. But I was probably excelling too fast. You know, I was going into kitchens with chefs that were 30 and 40 years old, looking at me going, who's this brat? And I'm like, well, man, I'm not a brat. I work my ass off for this stuff. Like I pushed extremely hard to get all these accolades and all these awards. So it kind of actually turned a little bit negative in my younger years at like 19, 20 and 21. So it was really hard to cop at that age.
How did you turn that around?
I took off. I left the country. I packed my bags. I went, I am not finished with the industry, and I need to tick a few more boxes. And my first trip was I took off to Japan and went over there. At that point, I was doing two sort of things in Sydney. At that point, I took on an executive chef role at a club, you know, in Sydney, which was a beautiful, beautiful club that they had these grand plans to do a fine dining restaurant and whatnot. And unfortunately, that fell through, which was very disappointing. So I did a little interim role at the moment, and I actually went and worked for a national cooking school out of absolute nowhere. This was just something that just kind of landed on my lap, going, hey, do you just want to help me out while my operations manager just resigned? I just need someone to help me out for a few months. And I think at that point that was one of the best things I did, in a sense, to connecting with customers and being in front of 20 people at a time and teaching how to cook and whatnot. And it actually kind of reconnected myself back with food and actually gave me the opportunity to be able to talk and, you know, be in front of customers and create a character where people were like, I really like this chef. This is really cool. So I'm very appreciative for that opportunity. But once again, I still went to Japan, went in on a solo trip, didn't tell anybody, just took off, went into, did, you know, stages and Michelin star restaurants over there, came back for a very brief stint, and then got a phone call from San Francisco by Dominic Cran and said, hey, I'll see you in 3 weeks. And I was like, done. All right, I'll pack my bags again. I went and got lost in San Fran. I didn't really tell anyone who I was, what I've done, what I've achieved. And I was quite happy to peel garlic at 5:45 in the morning. It was fine.
We've had Dominic Cran on the show. What was she actually like to work with? Do you have any stories?
Interesting time. The reason why it was interesting, it was World's Top 50 happening in Melbourne at the exact time. So I was flying out and she was flying in. So we didn't get to spend too much time together because she was on world tour at that time. Like, she was just all over the place. She really exploded on the scene. But from the few conversations we sat down and had a chat, from the few times that we we did have time to spend together. Very passionate, very charismatic. Her energy fills the room every single time. I think with her kitchens, she gives a sense of purpose to her chefs, and that's very important as well. And from what I've seen with her in her kitchen, she's a really cool chick.
How different was the kitchen in Atelier Crane compared to what you were used to in Australia?
It was really, once again, I'm so interesting again, because she has a very liberal style, and that's very much San Fran. Its style is very liberal. Everyone's very passionate and very calm and very friendly. But while I was there, I was like, I really want to tick something else on my box while I'm in San Fran. And during my days off, because obviously the common trend on this podcast right now is that I just don't like days off, I actually hooked up with Matthew Kirkley at Koi in San Fran. And Matthew Kirkley is the captain of the Bocuse d'Or team for America. And I hooked up with him and I was like, mate, I would really love to come work with you before I obviously wind up here and go back to Australia or figure out what I want to do, type of thing. And at that point, there was a few chefs at Atelier Crane who sort of, you know, did a little bit of a background search at that point and going, oh, actually, this chef is not what he's saying. He's back in Australia. He's got this and this and this and this. And I kind of had to explain myself why I didn't really talk to anyone about any of my achievements. It definitely wasn't a situation of me going there saying, oh, this is who I am and this is blah, blah, blah. This was me just going to switch off and just embrace the opportunity. So actually, I went and worked for Matthew Kirkley, and wow, that guy is on another level of detail that I've never seen before. And that was as traditional, as hardcore, as straight line kitchen that you could possibly ask for. And I think that was the authentic experience that I really wanted. I really wanted that military style kitchen where everyone was just dead quiet. There was metal rulers on the pass and everything was a precise millimeter. It doesn't matter what plate it was. I've never had a greater appreciation for peeling mandarin skins in my life. That was a great experience.
What did you do after then? And what was it like when you came back to Australia?
Well, I kind of came back in a weird way. I was sitting out in the courtyard of Atelier Crane. We're all having staff meal. We actually have a photo of it, and I'm sitting there with the group, all 15 of us, for only serving 25 customers that night. And I'm sitting out there. I'm actually looking on Gumtree, and I'm going like, I always have a look at what restaurants were for sale, what's going on, and maybe 5 or 6 years ago, like Gumtree was a pretty powerful tool to selling businesses. I'm looking around, and I saw this cafe pop up in Norwest Business Park, which is where Choir is right now. And I looked at this, I'm like, this looks really interesting. Like, it's on the water, it's in a business park, we're going to get corporate people, it's in a restaurant precinct, this looks okay. The cafe was pretty gross. It wasn't anything nice by any means. I made a call back to Australia. I got one of my friends to go over and have a look. And in usual fashion, everyone says, nah, you're crazy, why would you do that? The cafe's it's pretty run down, it's nothing nice at all. And I said, nah, stick with the process. I really like this. And pretty much at that point, I made a decision to leave. I had an offer to stay and to go work up in Calistoga and open up another restaurant for a very successful person. So that's northern San Francisco, probably just a little bit past Sonoma and Napa Valley region. And I just kind of missed Sydney. I missed Australia. America's great, but I just wanted to come home. So in that instance, I always planned for a departure at some point. I bought an amazing bottle of Shiraz. So I hope Dominic has drunk that by now. I went up to her. I handed her a Chris Ringland 2012 Shiraz, or might have been something like that. And I said, thank you very much for your time. I rang my auntie who was in she owns a travel agent. And I said, get me on the latest flight tonight. I'm ready to come home. And I just left. I was like, I just had this urge that I just needed to start my career. I needed to get back. I needed to start. And this was the best start that I could have.
Tell us a little bit about finding the site for Choir and what it was like to get it up and running.
The site at Choir, like, I was only going by Gumtree photos, so I was only guessing that this was going to be good. I rocked up, I looked at it, it was kind of on the lake. I was like, okay, the kitchen's very small, it's probably only going to be a 50-seater restaurant. And I was like, okay, like, I'm used to small kitchens, that's fine. If any chef listens to this and knows about competition career cooking, you've only got a tiny little bench to work from, so I can handle that, that's fine. The initial investment that time, I did have a business partner with me at that time who wasn't in hospitality, and that was probably one of my biggest mistakes, was probably going into a venture with someone who probably didn't understand hospitality and understand the investment and the workload and what you need to do early on. So in my humble opinion, looking back 2017 July to now, Kwa is absolutely in its best shape 6.5 years later. If I had a crystal ball and I went back in time, I would have done so many things different. I would have done so many things on a higher end, and I would have fixed this and done that. And, you know, unfortunately, that's just how business rolls, you know, and I had to sort of just cop it on the chin and start small and just work my way through it. And, you know, now I'm a sole business owner. I don't have any business partners with me now. And I thankfully had an amazing landlord who really helped through that whole process. And he last year came to me and sat down and goes, mate, from everything that you've done over the last few years and the adversity and the COVID and, you know, the business partner situation that happened, you know, the hard thing at that time, and I know there's going to be a few people shaking their heads right now on the phone, but the business partner I was with, I was actually in a relationship with their daughter, so it was quite difficult as well because we didn't end up going ahead. The landlord sat me down last year and goes, mate, I'd love you to buy the property. So last year I actually bought the property as well, so I'm actually an owner and occupier of Kwa, which is a massive achievement, and it's something that at 28 years old at that time, I was super thrilled, going, I can't believe I'm an owner occupier of my own restaurant. Like, I just thought that would never happen. And, you know, credit to Ray, the landlord, who just stuck with me over all those years and just understood, just was by my side, you know, and just went, you know what, mate, you deserve it. And I'm not going to slug you on the price, just pay me this. And it was very, very fair deal. And even though it was a hard transaction to do, he stuck it through every step of the way and made sure that I was the owner of that restaurant, you know, in that space, and also the owner of the business. So, yeah, it was awesome.
As we discussed at the top of the show, it's the only Hatted restaurant in the Hills District. But how different is the restaurant now compared to what you started with? Take us back to then, and what was the offering like, and how has it evolved?
So the offering was very much sort of like fresh out of Michelin star and very, you know, very ballsy. We're doing a lot of things just to try and get as many heads turning as possible in the local area. And I think now we've kind of just really hit sort of where our identity is, and that's just that very romantic, small 50-seater restaurant doing really beautiful produce, an amazing little degustation menu. And I think what we've done is we've just fine-tuned, and I guess I have fine-tuned my style of where I want to be, and that's just that classic Australian French-influenced food. Sorry, Nonna, for not doing Sicilian, apologies, but Italian food gets overused in this country too much. So I did stick with my apprentice training, which is, you know, French fine dining. The identity of the restaurant now is just, you know, the local hero. It's just, you know, you go there for your anniversaries, your birthdays. It's a special occasion place, and that's the way we position it. The food's contemporary, it's classic. You can come and have a steak and truffle fries for a midweek, or you can sit with your loved one and have either a short or long course degustation. And I think we're probably the only one in the whole area who offers that style of degustation.
Tell me a little bit about your food. Is there a couple of dishes that you can take us through that sort of exemplifies your food?
There would probably be two dishes that, if I was to remove them solely off the menu, we might have some type of riot at the front of the restaurant. Two dishes that have been there since day one is our classic steak tartare. We We just have an awesome recipe for it, and everyone absolutely adores our steak tartare. And it's been social media a lot that, you know, that we've always stacked up to having, you know, a very good quality steak tartare. And the other one is quite a simple dish, but the work that goes into it is just a black truffle risotto. It's just a truffle bowl, basically. It's as rich and as dense as possible, but it's a nice loose risotto. It's not a thick cheese style risotto like an Italian risotto. It's quite delicious. So there are two dishes on our menu that we've never removed, and we've just kept it on there.
You've achieved an extraordinary amount for a young man, but what's been the biggest challenge for you so far?
Biggest challenge for me would probably just would be me having to step through the processes and give things time. Like I am very... I'm a high achiever in a lot of areas, and I think my biggest challenge may is always been myself having to take a step back and letting things play in front of you the way they should and not forcing things. You know, I've spent a lot of time and development on myself as well, and I think it's super important for a lot of people when it comes to high performance CEOs or general managers or chefs or whatever, is just to do a lot of self-evaluation, step back and have a think and just learn more about yourself. I spent a lot of time with Dr. Jenny Dawson in her home in the valley, just sitting down with her and just learning and talking about these things, about the way the mind works, the body works, and how to connect all these dots together. And I'm super appreciative of her to spend that time. And also, she's a massive lover of my wine, so thanks, Jenny. Just to spend that time about learning more about yourself. So, you know, to answer your question, I think, you know, sometimes in life the biggest roadblock could be is you. And, you know, you maybe not giving yourself the absolute justice you deserve, which is just taking a step back and absorbing your surroundings and going, all right, what's next?
For someone who's created such a destination in the hills there and at such a high level as well, what sort of advice would you have for someone that might be looking to take that next step and create their own venue?
I would always say to anyone who I would mentor, including my team, is make sure your team around you is rock solid. And when I say team, I don't just say the people that's on your payroll. I say the people who are in your corner, you know, your accountants, your lawyers, your partner, whether it may be your wife or girlfriend, your family. Make sure everyone around you is aware. Make sure around you is supportive. Your team is critical. And I always say that to my staff, you know, like there's only so much you can do as a human being, but you need to make sure that your team around you is ready to jump in the trenches with you when things go south.
Well, Joshua, it's amazing what you've done so far, and I can't wait to see what you do from here. It's been an honour to have you on Deep in the Weeds to hear just a part of your story. Please keep in touch and we'll catch up again soon.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au.
Stay safe and be well.